Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
What an honor it's been to be talking to the author of The Biotic Message, Walter Remine. Walter, welcome back to Real Science Friday.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, you're very welcome. Fred, it's a dream come true to talk to Walter. This book has made such a significant impact on the creation evolution debate.
Yeah, that's right. And I think his book is quoted as much as any in creation literature. A lot of people refer back to a lot of the great things that were pointed out in this book.
All right. So, Walter, I was hoping we could talk about a few things that are maybe a little foreign sounding to the audience, like phonetics and cladistics, but they're so important. And to explain why they've become important, maybe we could talk about the period after Darwin. The period after Darwin, when the evolutionists thought that they were going to go all over the world, dig up fossils, and create this phylogeny, this obvious list of which organisms were the ancestors to which, that was a real time of encouragement and optimism, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. They believed that there would be ancestors in the fossil record. They'd be able to identify them and show them as evidence for evolution to prove their case.
Mm-hmm.
They were very excited about that possibility and took off on this research program for well over 100 years to try and identify the ancestors. And they tried lots of different methods to help them, give them hints and clues to who the ancestors were, but all these methods failed.
Okay, so Walter, I'd like to share a couple quotes with the audience from your section on Darwinian taxonomy to let people know that it's not just the creationists who are saying that they had a hard time. This is some of the world's leading evolutionists summing up in their writings, in their textbooks, what a disaster it was, the whole effort at classification and phylogeny.
Yeah,
Fred, do you have one of those?
Well, Ernst Mayr, isn't he a big name in evolution?
Ernst Mayr, he's one of the founders of what they call neo-Darwinism.
Well, I like one of the quotes Walter provided in his book, where Dr. Mayr said, "Honesty compels us to admit that our ignorance concerning these relationships is still great, not to say overwhelming.
Oh.
This is a depressing state of affairs, considering that more than 100 years have passed since the great post-origin period of phylogeny construction."
Wow. And that's from Ernst Mayr. He also says the futile attempts to establish the relationship of the major phyla of animals caused at least one competent zoologist at the turn of the century to deny common descent. And then what I love, Walter, about your work is then you quote the experts, the guys who wrote the book, literally. You quote Valentine and Ayala, and they are co-authors with Theodosius Dobzhansky on the textbook called Evolution. And they write on page 246, they say, "Classification has proven to be exceptionally difficult since the true phylogenies of most groups are not known for certain. Taxonomists tend to rely upon their own opinions as to the most plausible phylogeny." So that's not all hard science. This is people guessing what might have evolved into what.
It turns out that they couldn't identify the ancestors. The ancestors aren't there.
Mm.
And it took them over 100 years to really conclude that, to find that out. And once they did, they had to shift and change the way they were selling evolution to the public.
Mm.
Previously, during the Darwinian era, I call it, they were selling evolution using various illusions that they had identified the ancestors when they hadn't. Okay, and those illusions went down the drain in the mid-1970s.
Because the evolutionists themselves argued fiercely with one another, saying, look, you're claiming this creature is an ancestor of that one, and it just can't be true.
Yes.
Because the paleontologists would say, look, we found it in a strata 50 million years before. They're in the wrong order and so on. So they had to develop new ways of coming to their same conclusions. And I think that's where you enter into phonetics and cladistics.
That's correct.
In your book, you mentioned these two types of classification systems. Is this the newer Darwinian model, or did they use any of these back when Darwin first posited this theory?
These new methods are more clearly defined than the Darwinian system of classification.
Okay.
And you see what I call Darwinian systematics, the Darwinian method of classifying organisms. It attempted to identify the ancestors. That was key. Mm. And they wanted to base their classification system on it. But they couldn't identify the ancestors. They struggled and struggled and struggled, and eventually they failed. And in the mid-1970s, what rose up to take its place was cladistics and phonetics. Now, the common denominator of those two is that neither one of those methods identifies ancestors.
Well, that is so key. So let's describe phonetics and cladistics. Walter Remine, tell me if I got this right. Phonetics is a way to focus on whole bodies, entire organisms, and see how similar they are. Like you look at all different kinds of rodents, and they look sort of similar. So phonetics would draw some kind of a chart or a tree diagram, and they'd put all the rodents together if they look similar. Whereas cladistics will draw these tree diagrams, but they look at specific characteristics, like they'll look at whether or not something has a pouch to hold its young in. They'll look at whether something has echolocation or wings. And so cladistics doesn't look at creatures and their overall similarity of their whole body, but in very specific character traits.
That's correct on both points.
But the key is that neither of them identify ancestors.
Yes, absolutely.
And don't evolutionists kind of pick and choose which one they use? And that becomes an illusion in itself. They're like, oh, phonetics works for this case, or it makes it kind of look like it works. So, hey, here's a phenogram showing evolution, or they may use a cladogram in some other case, but it doesn't matter. Either way, they're not identifying ancestors.
You have it right.
So, Walter, when I've seen these beautiful tree diagrams at Wikipedia or the evolutionist I'm currently debating online, Aaron Ra, his YouTube videos have millions of views. He is a cladist. Everything he argues, his evidence for evolution everywhere are these clades. And so the clade diagram has all these leaves at the tips of the trees, but the branches are not proof of evolution. What they're doing is they're documenting a nested hierarchy of features. That's where the hard science is. It's at the tips of the branches. It is only assumptions that claim the diagram shows ancestry, so that the tips are where the data is, where the science is, and the branches themselves are assumptions.
Right. There aren't real ancestors there. Let me make an analogy for your audience. It's like we take books and we want to classify them for use in a library.
Mm.
So we classify a bunch of books together and say, well, those are the science books. And of the science books, some of those are biology books. Okay. Mm-hmm. We haven't identified any ancestors to the books. Okay.
Right.
We've manufactured a concept, a classification called science books and biology books that is something we manufactured in order to classify these books.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't identified ancestors for the books. And that's exactly what they do in these systematic methods of cladistics and phonetics. They manufacture what they call hypothetical common ancestors, but they're not real.
Yeah, I've seen it on Wikipedia. If you look up the section on evolution of dinosaurs, they show this picture of solid lines of different types of dinosaurs. And then underneath them are all these hypothetical lines. They're like dotted instead of solid. And so they're all hypothetical.
So the ancestors are hypothetical. Like when I asked Aaron Ra, what did a turtle evolve from? No answer. What did dinosaurs evolve from? And he said archaeosaurs. Well, archaeosaurs are a group that includes dinosaurs. So it's an illusion that, well, we know that dinosaurs evolved from dinosaurs.
Yeah.
That's an illusion.
The solid lines of the different dinosaurs, that's science. The dotted lines of the hypothetical stuff, that's religion.
So, Walter Remine, if we think of certain kinds of animals like, say, marsupials, they're the opposite of placental animals that have a placenta and an umbilical cord. Marsupials, their young grows in a pouch.
Right.
So if there are kangaroos that are marsupials and moles, little rodent creatures, and they both carry their young in their pouch, although their pouches are opening in the opposite direction, because if you were a mole, you're crawling through a dirt tunnel, your pouch would fill up with dirt if it opened the same way a kangaroo's does.
Uh-huh.
So it opens the other way. So then, Walter, when they draw their cladograms and phenograms, wherever the kangaroo and the mole appears on those charts, they're not going to appear in the same place on both of those tree diagrams. So it seems like that gives evolution a broad range for interpretation.
Yes, they can use either method, and whichever one they choose to use at the moment to create their illusions. But the common factor in both is that they don't identify ancestors, and that's been a huge change in evolutionary theory since the 1970s.
Okay.
The modern evolutionists strongly avoid identifying ancestors, and the reason is, as you said before, that once they try and identify an ancestor, they will get into an argument. Some other evolutionist will pipe up and say, no, you're wrong. Mm. That can't be. They get in arguments with other evolutionists about who the ancestor is. Mm. So the tendency is today that they avoid identifying ancestors altogether. And that's why they move to cladistics and phonetics, is because neither of them identifies ancestors.
Well, is this where convergent evolution comes into play? You know, for example, like the octopus and the human eye. Wouldn't that fall close on a cladogram? But obviously the octopus and the human aren't closely related. And boy, isn't there tons of examples of convergent evolution?
Well, Walter Remine, you have a section in your book on convergence and convergent evolution. So I'm glad Fred brought that up. Could you explain what the evolutionists mean when they talk about that?
Convergence. Yeah. An example is the striking similarity between the octopus eye and your eye.
Mm.
Both eyes have a lens and a retina and an iris that opens and closes, and muscles for rotating the eye, moving it in various directions.
Mm.
The similarity between these eyes is pretty striking, scary even. And
yeah.
Yet evolutionists say they did not evolve from an ancestor that had eyes.
Right. And when you say scary, when you look at an octopus and its eye moves towards you, like a fish would have to move its whole body, it's a little bit eerie to see in an octopus a biological function, a feature that we have. And so, wow, what do the evolutionists do if the supposed common ancestors of people and octopi didn't have this same kind of eye? What did they say?
Right. They said these eyes evolved completely separately, completely independently.
Wow.
The eye evolved once towards the octopus and then again towards the human eye. In fact, this same kind of eye, the complex eye like you and I have, it exists in humans, in the squid and octopus. It also exists in a worm, a annelid worm. It also exists in a spider. It also exists in a jellyfish. And these all, according to evolutionists, evolved completely independently, completely separate.
So we don't have a recent ancestor to the spider? Didn't you ever see Spider-Man?
So, Walter, remind, eyesight itself is said to have evolved separately 40 times. Then you have all the sophisticated kinds of optics, which are always well-suited to the species that have these different types of vision systems. And so all this, even though you'd look at the engineering requirements and say, this is wildly complicated and sophisticated, they say, well, evolution just did it. It created the same thing in all these different instances.
Yeah.
Big storytelling. I mean, I looked up Wikipedia on convergence, and it said that convergence, these examples we've been giving, is rife in nature. Would we expect that if everything arose naturalistically?
Well, we expect that. Walter Remine, does natural selection predict convergence like this?
No, it doesn't. Natural selection doesn't predict anything.
Well, you said in a previous interview, you said natural selection did not predict sexual reproduction,
right.
Yet it's everywhere.
Right.
And so convergence is everywhere, even like, for example, wings. What, in bats and birds and insects, wings evolved. And this sophistication of these wings. So they call it convergence. But just because they give a name to something, that doesn't mean that they've proved or even given evidence for the theory of how it came about.
Right. An important thing to understand is that what they're calling convergent traits, say the octopus eye and your eye, are traits that are so similar they demand an explanation.
Mm.
But these cannot be explained by common descent. They cannot be explained as atavisms or genetic throwbacks, and they cannot be explained as transpositions or lateral DNA transfer.
Well, genetic throwbacks, for the audience, that would be if a feature evolved millions of years ago and it was out there, maybe prevalent, and then we lost it because those genes were somehow covered up, and then later it reemerged.
Right.
Well, there's too much evidence in the data to say that's not how an octopus and a human ended up getting this kind of vision capability.
You know, sometimes my wife calls me a genetic throwback. But
yeah,
that's a...
she does. But that's a different issue, Fred. That's a counseling thing.
Yeah. No, I just gave three different examples of what is simple inheritance. That's common descent. That's simple inheritance. Mm-hmm. Atavism is another form of inheritance. The trait is developed in an ancestor, and then it's inherited by a distant ancestor, or masked and then unmasked into a distant ancestor. That's inheritance.
Hmm.
And another version of inheritance is where it occurs laterally. DNA is transferred from one organism to another, a distant organism, laterally, not from parent to offspring. It's transferred laterally.
Like HGT, horizontal gene transfer?
Right.
Right.
Now, these are three different versions of simple inheritance, and yet convergences cannot be explained by any of them.
So that the evolutionists, they, in their own writings, you have leading evolutionists who say, we have to stop talking about convergent evolution. It's too much of a just-so story. It's hardly plausible. And that is why some of them look for other mechanisms other than natural selection. Walter, one of the descriptions you put in your book that's been repeated 1,000 times is that evolution theory is like a fog that adapts to a landscape.
I love that quote.
That's so great. You just throw data at the theory and it just morphs around the data. Well, the fog does not predict the landscape. Like when a fog is settling in and coming into a valley, it doesn't predict the terrain of that valley. It just wraps around it. And so natural selection, Darwin's theory, doesn't predict these things that are everywhere. They just find out, wow, this squid eye is just like a human eye. Well, it must have just happened. Just a merry coincidence that it happened.
Yeah, this theory is very adaptable.
Hmm.
But let me point out something. It's important to understand why convergence is so abundant in nature. It is super abundant in life. You see it at the morphological level. You see it at the embryological level among embryos. And you also see it at the biochemical level and genetic level.
Proteins.
Convergence is super abundant everywhere.
Mm.
And it's important to understand why, because evolutionists can't explain it.
Life
was designed to resist evolutionary explanation.
And hence the title of your book, The Biotic Message, that the designer included in his creation the stamp of his existence.
Yes.
You make that point with the Piltdown hoax, the fraud, where you say that scientists using the technique of intelligent design determined that there was someone who created the Piltdown fossil. Although we don't know his identity, we know his existence.
Yes.
What a brilliant example of evolutionists using intelligent design.
Yes.
I just love that. Could we get into the big area of Haldane's dilemma?
Yes.
Okay. And Walter, I think you're especially well known for this, because Haldane is maybe one of the top 20 evolutionists of the 20th century. He was involved with the modern evolutionary synthesis, but he presented this dilemma that I think you have done more than anyone else living to bring this to a wider audience. So could you explain to us Haldane's dilemma?
Yes, Haldane developed a theory that's pretty solid, that shows there's a limit to the speed at which beneficial evolution can occur.
Hmm.
And it turns out to be so slow that it looks like you cannot explain, say, human evolution within the available time.
Because we only have 5 million years or so to get from chimps or a chimp-like creature to us.
Right. The speed at which evolution can make beneficial change is too slow to explain that change from, say, chimps to humans in the available time.
Okay. I have two questions right off the bat about that. For decades, evolutionists have tried to exaggerate the similarity between human and chimp DNA. And we have a recent paper published where they count all the insertions and deletions. This is a peer-reviewed journal. I think it was in Nature. And they said, look, there's about a 5% difference. That's a lot more than a 98.5% similarity, 5%. So would Haldane's dilemma cause evolutionists to try to minimize the changes required to get from a chimp to a human being?
Yes. They're in a bind right now to try and explain the amount of genetic change they're claiming has occurred.
Because if there is about a 5% difference, when you take the whole genome into account, that's about 100 million base pairs. So then my second question is, they've said for decades that most of this stuff is junk. Most of it is irrelevant. Does Haldane's dilemma push them in that direction to say that the genome is mostly junk? It doesn't matter what's in there.
Yes, because they can't explain the vast amount of change that appears to have occurred. And so they're trying to minimize in some way the amount of change that has occurred. So junk DNA, the idea of junk DNA has been high on their list for the last 20 years. It's been disappearing.
The junk is disappearing.
Yeah, it's kind of going the way of the vestigial organs argument.
What a great analogy.
Vestige of its former self. Vestigial organs used to be a very important argument in favor of evolution, and now you haven't heard of it for a long time.
Right.
Junk DNA is going the same way.
Well, Walter, one of the components is the cost of harmful mutation, right? I liked your section where you showed that based on current rates at that time, each breeding pair would have to produce 40 offspring.
Yeah.
And as I know, one of the studies that compared chimp to human DNA to determine the harmful rate, those guys were assuming the 98.5 similarity in the DNA. So, Walter, I remember one of your cost arguments is the harmful mutation cost, where you showed that each breeding pair would have to produce 40 offspring per breeding couple, right?
Yeah.
So I remember emailing a person who had done a study that showed that the harmful rate was 3 per person per generation. And he did that by comparing human to chimp DNA. And the assumption at the time was that there was like 98.5 similarity. Well, they weren't including the insertions and deletions. And I had asked, well, what would your rate be if you included those? And it was a huge number, like in the tens of thousands of offspring would be needed per breeding couple. So is that part of why the similarities become less? It becomes more of a problem. Is that part of the problem, Walter? Was I understanding that correctly?
The figure on the mutation rate sounds to me way low. Way low. The mutation rate they're measuring in humans and higher life forms right now is, depending on the evolutionist you care to cite, the figure is somewhere between 100 and 300 new mutations per offspring.
Yeah, and this 3 per person was the harmful rate. It wasn't like the ones they call neutral, the deleterious
rate. They claim that most are neutral.
And I remember sending this to Professor Crow, and I think he passed away recently. James Crow. He published quite a bit in the Science and Nature magazine.
Evolution.
And he admitted it was a serious problem that deserved a serious answer. This is on the cost mutation problem. And then he provided me with some math on truncation selection, which he even admitted was not conclusive.
Well, that's how the dinosaurs went extinct. They were just truncated off of the face of the earth. So, Walter, what of these things? We only have a couple more minutes, and it's somewhat difficult for us to wrap our minds around.
Yeah. Let me give you a simple example of this mutation rate thing. The mutation rate that they're measuring now, more accurately, is so high that it looks like error catastrophe is a serious problem. That is, error catastrophe and mutational meltdown, those are the synonymous terms. Is where the population builds up harmful mutations faster than it can get rid of them.
Right.
Okay.
And that's happening.
The mutation rate they're measuring right now is so high, it's hard to get around the problem of mutational meltdown. It's hard to explain it away. It's a live issue.
Well, the inventor of the gene gun, Cornell Professor Emeritus John Sanford agrees with you completely.
Yeah.
He quotes you in his book, Genetic Entropy. So this is a serious problem. He says that this shows that all the species on Earth cannot last another million years. We'd all be gone.
Yeah, we're de-evolving.
Because of mutations.
Yeah. Now, a team of creationist geneticists that he led, Dr. Sanford led the team. I was on the team. We developed a computer simulation of evolution. And it's the best, most advanced, most biologically accurate computer simulation of evolution.
And we mentioned this in a previous show, Mendel's Accountant.
Yes. You can download that program for free and run it on your own computer. And you plug in values, lots of parameters that you get to choose and set yourself. You set those to any realistic value you'd like and watch the error catastrophe and genetic deterioration occur. The population will go extinct pretty quick.
So have you gotten any serious evolutionists to try it or comment on it?
They're remaining pretty quiet about it. But ours isn't the only simulation that shows this. There are evolution simulations that show the same thing.
Hey, Walter, you guys are pretty depressing. This is a sad thing, right? This is a result, I believe, as a Christian, of the fall. And things are not improving. They're not evolving toward higher states of being. Things are falling apart. There's information entropy at work here in the genome of millions of species.
Yeah, it's a live issue.
Mm. Yeah, and they don't really talk about this one. They spend more time talking about how we're improving.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the kind of the lamest arguments I hear is how somebody will say, well, haven't you ever seen those old submarines from 200 years ago and you had to be really short to walk through them?
Right, right.
And, yeah. Silly.
So the designers got better.
Spacious arguments.
The submarines didn't evolve.
Yeah.
So, Walter Remine, we are out of time. Do you have any current project you're working on?
Yes. Yes. I'm looking at making a video course on intelligent design versus evolution.
Wow. That sounds really great. We'll want to get our hands on it as soon as it's available. Walter, thank you so much for your life's work and then for spending the time with Fred Williams and I on Real Science Friday.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it was great, Walter. Thanks.
What an honor, Fred. We did it. We interviewed Walter Remine. And he really is one of the key figures in the battle between creation and evolution. So that was a lot of fun. Our website is realsciencefriday.com. And we have a store that if you get our science materials, it'll help us stay on the air. God bless you. Hi, this is Bob Enyart with Real Science Friday. You can get great science materials from us. DVDs from Illustra Media that we carry, The Privileged Planet, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, and Darwin's Dilemma. And then there are the two fabulous DVDs from Dr. Carl Werner on Evolution, The Grand Experiment, Living Fossils. You'll want to see those. And then Spike Passaris, formerly with the U.S. Military Space Program, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy. We have two DVDs on our seminar, Does God Exist? And then Mount St. Helens, The Explosive Evidence for Catastrophe. We also have our debate on the age of the Earth, where I got to debate a mathematician from CU up in Boulder and a geophysicist on this MP3 CD. And finally, my favorite science book, In the Beginning, by Dr. Walt Brown. Just call us at 800-8-ENYART, 800-836-9278, or check out our online store in the science department either at kgov.com or realsciencefriday.com.